Today's talk is given by Phil James of Newcastle University Senior Lecturer in GIS. His talk is entitled Urban Observatory Mapping Our Future Cities. Once upon a time, a software developer at Nissan, I think. Phil worked on 3D CAD systems and various things such along those lines, and joined the then Department of Surveying in 1995 as a systems programmer and IT advisor. Since then, he has continued to focus on the development of systems and software in the geospatial field. Research interests include the Internet of Things, so specifically geosensors and embedded sensors, next-generation analytics, including real-time data, processing, modelling, simulation, prediction, all of that, and also spatial data management in both traditional relational systems, which will appeal to some, and also NoSQL-type structures. Phil also worked closely with civil engineers and transport and water resources on a range of Earth systems engineering problems, focusing on the development of software and systems using spatial data. One of the big things at Newcastle is urban observatories, and of course using the whole city as a laboratory. You may recall our December talk on designing with the city as a database here in Edinburgh, and our recent talk on 3D GIS, so you can perhaps spot some related themes. So the sort of plan is to therefore look forward to completing the picture regarding our understanding of modern cities and possibly how we can live and work more efficiently and sustainably. So I think who better than Phil to talk to us.
Thank you very much. First of all, thank you very much for the invite. Just like to start by saying sort of how we got here. It's quite an interesting, at least to me, an interesting story. I've been involved in, I'm lucky enough, I don't know whether that's the right word, to work in a civil engineering department, of which the geomatics spatial data group form a significant part. So I've been involved in a number of projects stretching back now 15 years where we've been monitoring stuff and then building data interfaces to stuff, all in these tight, compartmentalised, sectorialised, vertical columns of data. So we've been involved with developing the data structures, interfaces and tools for the UK Climate Programme, UKCP09. We've done a lot of work. Our first air quality monitoring campaign with pervasive sensors started in 2005, so we've been doing that for 10 years. We've been monitoring the Eden catchment, where the floods in Carlisle have been going for a number of years. Somewhat ironically, we lost about 60% of our monitors in both of the flood events, but there you go. That's what happens when you stick things next to rivers. So I've been involved in all of these projects, and one of the things that has been obvious to me as a sort of spatial data person, and that's why I get involved, because they want to produce a web map, and they want to manage their data, and they want to do some analytics, and those analytics require some sort of spatial component. So they get us involved. And I'm sitting there thinking, there's all of this data, and it's all really interesting, but it's all siloed and structured, transport databases, UTFC compliance, XML horrors that no one wants to go anywhere near. There's all of these data out there that we do monitor that we want to try and integrate. So we've tried on a number of occasions to various research councils and funding bids to try and get a system, a vision funded about bringing all of these things together, bringing all of these monitored data together in a way that makes them accessible to a variety of people, not just researchers, but businesses and other things. And it's been extraordinarily difficult to engage some of the traditional research funders in this, because what are you building? You're building a thing. We're not actually answering particularly any questions. But fortunately, they demolished the brewery site in Newcastle. Some people, if you drunk Newcastle brown ale, you'll know why that is, fortunately. They are brewing it elsewhere these days. So we've got this massive, grey big 20-hectare site right smack bang in Newcastle city centre, and right next to St James's Park. And the university and the city council have pooled resources and are developing this site. And they're throwing lots of money at concrete and various other things. And someone said, wouldn't it be a good idea, if we're building lots of buildings, why don't we have some research going on the side of it? So some hastily put together internal funding came about, and this is where we are at the moment. Fortunately for us, we've now managed to convince the powers that be that this is a really great idea, and we've got a significant funding boost from the UCRIC, which the Chancellor finally signed off on last September. Right, I hope I don't have to convince the audience here that monitoring cities in some way is fundamentally, whatever its flaws and everything else, is fundamentally a good idea. So in order to monitor and meet these grand challenges of our future cities, we have to have some form of monitoring of them. Any sort of experimentation you want to do starts with observation. If you want to understand how something's changed, you observe it beforehand. You put in a small change, hopefully one change, rather than two or three changes at the same time. You observe the effect and you extrapolate from that some understanding of the system or systems that are going on. That's how scientific experimentation works. So if we're to meet some of these grand challenges of data, we need to start thinking about how we monitor cities. What we monitor, the scales at which we monitor. So things are happening over very short wavelengths. There are short wavelength patterns. They may be queuing traffic at a traffic light, where you've got a short wavelength pattern over 30 seconds, you've got a queue and then you haven't got a queue. And we've also got long wavelength patterns happening. So the city is changing and evolving through lots and lots of different influences. So there's some grand challenges for future cities that we have to try and meet. And of course, observation isn't the only thing that's required. If you want to think about risk here in the middle, the risk to our cities, whatever that is, and all the things that we can do to improve that, we have to understand what's going on, we have to observe it, but we also have to integrate modelling and analysis. We then have to somehow synthesise all of these models that may well be dealing with a particular sector, or if you're really looking two sectors, and start to try and understand the patterns of a city, and that all then feeds back into our observations. So observations don't sit there in isolation. Doing this, mind, is non-trivial. I'm sure many of you here work with complex data. There's a problem with how we manage all of these data. So we have a real data management challenge. We've got lots of legacy systems out there. People are already monitoring quite a lot. People are monitoring things often for operational purposes. In case something breaks, they can go and fix it. And they've developed legacy systems for doing that. They've got legacy data architectures for doing that. We also have a problem, which I'm sure many of you are familiar with, scale. Because at what scale are we modelling and therefore managing our data? Are we modelling that at a city scale? Are we modelling that at a neighbourhood scale? Are we modelling that at the scale of a building? There is a big issue with how we start approaching this data management. And if you think about the variety of heterogeneous data sources that we have to deal with, that throws up another challenge. So, in order to understand our cities, we have to deal with all of this type of data. Many of you, this type of data will be familiar to you. We have map type data, so there's some master map data here. We have networks data, so we have infrastructure networks which we can represent spatially and topologically, and obviously they exist in the real world, and these end nodes are possibly one of these buildings which are consumers of these infrastructure networks, be they water, gas, electricity, telecoms, whatever they are. We also have Earth observation data. So there's a wealth of, as you well know, satellites flying over, collecting data on a repeat cycle, which we also have to deal with. And then there's lots of new data sources, streaming data from sensors and that type of things, the Internet of Things, or as people like to call it. There's also the whole issue of social media data and citizens as sensors, and how do we integrate those types of data into our analysis? How do we manage those data? All of these represent very different challenges in terms of being able to manage the data, being able to query across those data. Querying across a spatial database with some vectors in it is one thing. Querying across a 1,000 raster image files over a certain area is again something that we can do, but it's relatively complex. Spatial querying on real-time streaming data from social media, and then trying to integrate all of those together. So these heterogeneous data sources are a real big headache. We've also got an issue here of when we're monitoring our cities is the issue of uncertainty and sensitivity in our models themselves and in our data. We don't deal in absolutes, and we model, we abstract reality into simple forms in order to be able to answer questions, which generates uncertainty. If you think about climate futures, this is a modelling work done on the Thames estuary, and depending on which of your particular climate futures you pessimistically or optimistically select, we end up with very different outcomes. We've also got the issue of how do we start visualising all of this data. So this is one of my visualisations with data. This is data taken from Twitter, where we generated synthetic routes based on people tweeting from two different locations over a particular period. And what's happening here is these red dots are being brought in as real-time failures in the network. So we're artificially failing the network, and then that's causing a redeployment of the flow on the fly and showing increased flows across different bits of the network. So this is taking data from social media, spatial data because it's geolocated, generating flow data from those by analysing that data, and then turning that into something that's understandable. If you go to any of the Office of the Deputy Prime Minister's things on infrastructure, you'll see this or a version of it. I've now seen it in about 15 different presentations since it went up on YouTube. It's very hard to visualise these things dynamically. This one uses a gaming engine in the background, so we've got a gaming engine that generates the animation. We're not quite at the point where we can do this on the fly, but it's not far off, and certainly when you start engaging, you know, cloud computing resources, as we're starting to look at, you can start to see that you can start to generate these types of visualizations from data in near real time or on demand. Not necessarily with real time data, but as and when they're required. We also have to think about how do we communicate our information, given that we are probably, although I might disagree with that in a minute, coming under a sort of tsunami. If you read the press, there's a tsunami of data coming. There's a big data problem. There's lots of things happening. How do we make sense of this to policymakers and stakeholders? How do they explore that data? So we have to think of new ways of visualising our data. This is some visualisation work that my colleague Stuart Bardier is part of the ITRC group, which is looking at networks, infrastructure networks. So thinking of interesting ways of visualising data to communicate information to your target audience is absolutely imperative. And then we've got to manage all of this data. We've got to think of ways of handling all of this data. So the big picture is we're trying to think about all of these big problems that cities are faced with, depending on which city. Newcastle, like Edinburgh, doesn't really suffer from a drought problem. And although we modelled tsunamis hitting the North Sea, just for fun, it's unlikely to happen. But air quality today, I've seen some air quality metrics. Newcastle, London had an air quality problem. It exceeded its yearly threshold within 6 days. Newcastle, like most cities, has an endemic air quality problem. Everything is at threshold or above. The solution to this, in many places, is not to monitor, because then you don't have a problem. So in Newcastle, the AURN site, one of those is now closed down. The other one is in the local authority car park, which, whilst full of cars, is a long way from a main road. So there's not much of a problem there. So there are a lot of technologies that we're starting to investigate as working in conjunction with our friends, the computing scientists, in terms of being able to deliver these systems at multiple scales in cities. So lots of different types of observation. That might be outputs from our models, it might be sensored systems, which I'll talk about a bit more here. Crowdsourcing, which is an integral part of doing Earth observation data, GNSS and SAR and those types of things. So how do we manage all of these big data systems? How are we structuring them? What sort of databases do we use? How do we integrate these heterogeneous data sources? How do I run a spatial query across streaming data, 1,000 raster images, a bunch of static data, and a vast historical archive of Twitter data? How do I do that all at once at pretty good time to get some information out? And then, of course, a whole bunch of new and really interesting modelling we can start to do on the end of this when we start building these systems. So that's my sort of introduction as to why we're doing this and some of the challenges we're facing. And I don't pretend to be even answering a small number of those, but these are the sort of framework into which we're trying to operate as part of what we're doing in the Urban Observatory. Now, unless you've been hiding under a rock for the last 10 years, or 5 years, it's about 5 years, you will have seen in the press Smart City. Smart City is one of those labels where you just have to be one, regardless of whether you are or not. So Smart City, Future City, whatever you want to call it, we're all a Smart City, we're all a Future City. Liverpool's a smart city. Edinburgh's a really smart city. Amsterdam, smart city. Barcelona, smart city. Delhi, they're really smart as well up there in Delhi. New York City. And of course, let's not forget Milton Keynes. That's really smart. Actually, when you start to delve a little deeper into all of these smart cities, and, you know, which I have done, and I've looked at lots of smart city programs and smart city and what they are, there's not a lot of substance. There is very little substance behind the smart city. It's very easy to say we're going to build a smart city, but nobody quite agrees on what a smart city is. No one quite agrees on how they're going to go about this. Are we doing it from the top down? Are we doing it from the bottom up? Are we doing this geographically? Are we doing this as a matter of policy? And actually, the truth is a long way from the marketing hype. So I like to call this, instead of smart cities, I like to call Newcastle just a slightly less dumb city. That's where I'm pitching this as. Slightly less dumb cities, if you like.
I was in the pub the other day, suspended disbelief for one moment.
I was in the pub the other day, and one of my friends who runs a pizza restaurant said, "You do all that city nonsense, don't you?" And I said, "Well, yes, I suppose that's as good as any." For years, I've been telling my wife, whenever anyone asks me what I do, and I say, instead of explaining, I'm a spatial scientist and I do this, that, and the other, maps and computers. Maps and computers is where I'm at. So, but, you know, we've chatted in the pub a few times about what we're doing, and usually their eyes glaze over. But he said to me, "I think the traffic's got worse since the petrol prices have gone down. Is that right?" And I said, "Well, that's a really interesting question, and I'm sure, and you know, if I was an expert in this, I could probably go and find some data about traffic patterns in Newcastle or wherever. Some of that is collected automatically. I know we've got automatic number plate recognition, scoop systems in various places. We often see those, generally speaking, gentlemen of a more senior age taking notes on the side of roundabouts, counting cars, so there's obviously surveys going on. And I'm sure I could go and find some of that data eventually, and then try and find some archive data going back a suitable amount of time, and then go and get the average petrol price for Newcastle from somewhere, I'm not entirely sure where, and then attempt to answer that question." But actually, even trying to answer a really sensible question like that, without going off and doing a 12-month research contract, because the data is really hard to get hold of, is quite difficult. And there's lots of questions you can come up with that actually we spend most of our time looking for, finding, cleaning up, understanding the data structures, extracting from whichever weird system it's been stored in, to get a bunch of data out to try and answer a question. So, building slightly less dumb cities should be the subtitle of this talk. When you go into the smart cities, future cities space, what you see is this sort of viper's nest of marketing mumbo jumbo about how it's a done deal. Smart cities are a done deal. All we need to do is just put sensors out everywhere, measure everything, and then we'll know everything. And that's it, it's done. And you read the literature, and it's done. It's not a problem. We're going to do this in smart city, we're going to do this smart city, we're going to do this smart city. There's a sort of tacit understanding that what a smart city act is really wireless everywhere, and that suddenly somehow makes it smart. That's a euphemism, I think. Smart city means we can all look at Facebook wherever we are, and we don't have to pay any 4G charges. Actually, the science of sensing, if there is such a thing, I'd like to put myself up there as the first professor, if anyone's interested in employing me. The science of sensing is very poorly understood. How many sensors should I deploy at a particular data quality in order to get a good representation of the urban environment? There's a fundamental question about sensing that no one's yet answered. Do we need one every 50 metres? Do I need two in a city? Do I need three in a city? obviously, you can say, well, that depends on what question you're trying to answer and at what scale and all the rest of it. But we haven't really fundamentally tried to explore this science of sensing. Now, I don't know whether you've ever had the misfortune to speak to the purveyors of miracle cures, or sensor companies, as I like to call them, because they are full and replete with these brilliant devices that you scatter around the place and they collect loads of data and they're absolutely brilliant. Actually, sensor technology, as I'll show a couple of examples in a minute, isn't yet ready. So all of this talk of smart cities, our sensors just really aren't up to it. They aren't up to it in terms of measuring things reliably. They aren't really up to it in terms of comms. The sensors themselves are poorly understood. There is one manufacturer making virtually all the chemical sensors for all of the companies who are saying they are selling air quality sensors. Anything that costs you less than £5,000 is all being made by the same company. So they're all the same, regardless of what. There's a lot of problems with codependency and drift in a lot of our sensors as well. So there's a huge chunk of work needed to be done in the sensor technology. At the same time, we are getting, as we'll see, we get good data, but it needs to be improved. So sensor technology has good, is not yet there. Our data quality is poor. Not only is it poor, poor's great because if you know how poor it is, because you can choose your results and you can draw conclusions based on your uncertainty, and that's absolutely fine. But if you have a sensor that starts off being good but drifts off because of environmental factors over an unknown amount of time, then that's a problem, so you've got this drift in it. We have sensors that are affected by other environmental factors, so the sensors for NOx are also affected by ozone. So you get this sort of codependency going on, and most of the sensor manufacturers, either on board or in some even worse, in cloud system, are doing some sort of corrections on their data before they get released into the wild. So they're correcting their data based mostly on experimentation rather than any sort of theoretical underpinning. Processes for deployment are extremely long-winded. I have a very, very long-suffering RA who has been working on this project for just over a year, and I hope we're going to be able to keep her. But it's a frustrating process, deploying sensors. If you gave me now £100,000 and said, we'd like a load of sensors in Edinburgh, I reckon I could probably get them up and running, maybe if I'm lucky, in 6 months. The hoops you have to go through to deploy these things are really quite difficult. Let's not talk about financing and maintenance rates. We're in a very fortunate position at Newcastle. We've got 5 years secured funding. We've got £3.5 million. We've got people, not just capital. We all know how good research councils are at employing capital, but they aren't so good at giving us people to actually do stuff with that capital investment. We've got people. But what happens post 5 years? Hopefully we carry on, hopefully we have a streaming fund, but there are no sort of financing and maintenance arrangements. All of our sensors that we currently deploy, we've got about 100 out there, we're hoping to get in the next 5 years, maybe up to 500 or 600. You have to go and replace the batteries on them every 6 months. So it becomes a full-time job for someone just walking around replacing batteries on sensors. How does that fit? How do we build maintenance arrangements with city councils or SSE, who seem to control all the lampposts in Newcastle, to go out and manage these things? I know there's a bit of talk about city data standards, but there's no real agreed standard yet. The OGC is making some noises about another horrible XML dialect. And God help us all, frankly. So we're going to be able to store everything in XML, because that's worked in the past, boys. Remember that one. What about data security? democratising deployment. Where do we deploy? Are we going to have sort of sensor-rich areas where people are clamouring, saying, "I want to monitor my air quality," and the, you know, the deprived areas of the city, well, we'll just let them. How do we manage all of this thing from a sort of social perspective? So I think the smart city marketing hype is all there. And one of the things we have to worry about is who's poised, waiting to pounce, if we don't do it. I was going to put vultures, but actually it is a sort of quite attractive thing to many councils, governments, things like that. Who's sitting there poised? Microsoft, big. Google, massive. Siemens, falling over themselves to get involved. Philips, all of these companies, IBM, Intel, are all standing there in the smart city space, and we all know what they want to do. They want to sell kit, and they want to sell software, and they want to tie city councils. And it's quite attractive if you're told you need to monitor air quality across your city, and IBM come in and say, "Give us several million pounds, and we'll do it for you." And but by the way, in 10 years' time, it's going to cost you a lot more. They're the ones waiting to pounce here if we're not doing it, or groups aren't doing it. So, the Urban Observatory, what is it? Well, the Urban Observatory, if you want to sort of try and visualise it, is all of these bits of which we've started to do, bits of which we're doing. We're, in doing it, we're trying to understand some of the science of sensing. We're trying to generate processes that allow us to deploy quickly. In essence, we have big databases. We have APIs and data downloads, so you can get your data. We have portals and things like that. We want to integrate, obviously, the normal geospatial data, static data. We haven't yet, we just started to think about how you integrate some of the softer data, linked data, with our static data, with real-time data, to start to understand the real observatory of a system. I suppose the key elements at the moment that we're focusing on are this urban sensor network, building an urban sensor network at scale, in the wild, in the real world, with real stuff. Integrating volunteered information. We're part of the Digital Civics Research Centre, which is a 5 million EPSRC programme, which is all about using digital technology to improve civic life. So we're integrating volunteered information from apps and those. We also integrate and consume data from social media. Instagram and Facebook, Instagram and Twitter in the first instance, but other things are certainly possible. So these are inputs into our system, and they provide outputs, which also feed back in. The red really here denotes that we've only just started along this journey in terms of the colours here. So in thinking about how you then take all of this data and start to visualise complex and dynamic data with dashboards, that type of thing, how we start thinking about data mining, and particularly in my case, spatial data mining across multiple heterogeneous platforms with both shortwave and longwave patterns in them, and how we start extrapolating information. Linking this into existing and new data modelling workflows and cloud workflows, how we scale this stuff up. And then, of course, ultimately, the whole point of this is to make better decisions in the city, so integrating platforms for decision support. So that's the sort of bits that we're trying to do. Most of what we've currently done to date is sort of in this bit here. So, what's been done in the past, a lot of this, is we know that top-down approaches to observatories usually fail. The sort of we measure it, you use it type of view of the world is actually quite difficult to do. Because it's why bother in the first place, who's going to use it, what exactly are you measuring, are you measuring the right things, that sort of thing. But you do develop a baseline of data, and we hope to foster this idea of sensing by default, not sensing as an add-on. So when new infrastructure goes out, the sensing is part of it. When we exploit systems, communication systems, sensing is part of it. What's often more successful, and I'm sure there's lots of examples here as there are in Newcastle and everywhere else in the world, is we've all put out projects in the wild, we've all done pilot projects. They're often very successful if you measure success by we got 3 papers out of it and a research grant. But there's no long-term sustainability of that data. We've got drawers full of CDs and DVDs from monitoring data on the Eden catchment. And they're the ones I know about. There's probably drawers that have been emptied when the researchers go. So there's no sort of, it's difficult to achieve long-term sustainability. They may well be isolated geographically. So our approach is to try and combine that. So do some of the top-down, build an infrastructure, make it accessible, infuse people about urban monitoring, say, look at all this data we've got, but also do very focused research-driven projects that fit into and contribute to this larger framework. And what we hope is that sort of integrated approach actually gives us a sustainable pattern moving forward. This is all part of the slightly unfortunately acronymed Digital Enabled Urban Sustainability. The city as a living laboratory. This is the old Newcastle Brewery site. This is our new, spanking new urban science building. This urban science building has about £5.5 million worth of sensors in it, down to individual plugs, and a switchable AC-DC grid, so we can monitor what goes in and what goes out. Although they did draw the line at chemical analysers on the toilet. They wouldn't let us put those in. That was the only thing, computing science are moving in now. I don't know what it says about computing scientists, that they don't want drug analysers on their toilets, but there we are. The other thing they didn't want us to do, and we're vehement about, and we still haven't managed it, is actually tracking where people are in the building. Not because I think they don't want us to track where they are in the building, they just don't want us to know they're not in the building, because they're academics. So, and they're working from home during the months of August and July. I think that's the main reason. Casting no aspersions. There's lots of interesting science questions. Move away, you know, I'm no transport specialist, I'm no water specialist, I'm no climate modeller. Just thinking about the data in an observatory for an urban thing, there's lots of interesting scientific questions that we haven't yet even started to properly answer. I mean, these are just a few of the ones that came to mind while I was sitting here writing this presentation. How do we citizens become part of the observatory? How do they contribute? How do they consume this data? How do we make it available for them? How do we turn city data into actionable information? There's lots of research questions there. So although we're talking about technology and processes, underpinning all of this, above and beyond the sectorial sort of standard research questions that our research specialists think of, our domain specialists think of, there's lots of things about geospatial data, data handling and analytics in the urban sphere that we haven't yet started to address. Now, I shamelessly nicked some of these from a defunct smart city thing that Dublin started and has now gone, because I can't find any reference to it whatsoever. So, like many of these projects, there's a big fanfare, there's a couple of articles in the press, there's something done and then it wanes and disappears.
But the icons survive.
Sorry?
But the icons survive.
Oh no, they're my icons. Oh, yeah. Yeah, I didn't nick the icons, I just nicked some of the ones in the middle here. But actually I thought, in terms of an ethos of what we're trying to do, this is a really strong message that we're trying to get across in what we're trying to do here. Develop an information baseline for interventions so we can, when we change stuff, we know how it's changed. It sounds straightforward, it's actually quite hard. Create sustainable urban monitoring, strengthen local capacity, promote a culture, this sensing by default rather than anything else. And really start to address what we all say we're going to do in research proposals and they never do, which is this cross-sectorial, multi-scale monitoring research. We write it up in the end in the report, saying how interdisciplinary we are. This is Airstream's Urban Observatory, that they, and this is a proper observatory, and I suppose I wanted to make the distinction. Whilst they're doing really good things in terms of an urban observatory, what I consider an urban observatory isn't exactly this type of just something we can view. Although I suppose the thing about being able to compare cities is really interesting, and again, that's another scientific question. How do we compare one city to another? How do we cross-fertilise good ideas? So what sort of things are we monitoring? And what sort of things can we monitor? Well, we can monitor water in pipelines. Northumbria Water give us access to their network data, so we get real-time data of both the wastewater and clean water. We monitor climate and weather. I suppose weather is what we monitor. Climate is what we work out from putting all those weather observations together. Electricity networks are also monitored. People movements, traffic movements and flows across the city, air pollution, public transport. We did have, one of the things that we do is we don't try and reinvent the wheel. So if someone's already monitoring it, let's get their data. And many, given the ethos of open data, actually many people are producing APIs to their own data, or even if they're not producing it, you can go and talk to them and say, we'll produce one for you and other people can use it and we consume it. We did have all the car park data, but someone snipped through the wires at the Civic Centre 8 months ago, so they've all gone dead, and it doesn't seem to be the funds. Wind, water, water quality, water levels, and those types of things. These are all the sorts of things we can monitor. What we want to monitor is we do want to start capturing these medium and long wavelength patterns in a city. And the only way you can do that is monitor for a long time. If you're trying to look at air quality, for instance, you have to look at days that were the same climatically, because the wind has a huge effect on air quality. So if you're trying to say what was the effect of traffic, you've first got to find 10 days that were the same climatically in order to be able to do that. So it requires you to monitor these things for a long time. So first off, we need to monitor for a long time. We also have to think about real-time systems and integrating those systems into modelling and the rest of it. And we also have to think about how on earth do we then bring in Earth observation data as an asset that we can use? How do we start thinking about problems that we face in the past with downscaling measurements? This is repeat data, it's really useful, but how do we integrate this into a whole urban ecosystem? So, one of the things that our ethos is this is going to happen really piecemeal. And if you want to really sense a city, you can't go out there and say, right, I'm going to sense the city, there you go, blank check, off you go. It's never going to happen. It's going to cost too much. But you think about this as an evolving system where we bring in sensors, they are deployed, we add other sensors to it, some sensors die, new sensors come online, and we start to grow this in an evolutionary manner. Now you see where the slide came from. This evolutionary manner, we can start to understand things. But that requires us to build data structures and systems that handle multiple platforms and enable us to communicate to multiple sensor platforms. The benefit of this is we don't have tie-in. You don't tie into a particular manufacturer, you don't tie into a particular comms. You can start to add state-of-the-art, you can have multiple different sensors from multiple different vendors, all working within the same environment. The trick is to make it easy for the consumers of that data to be able to get that data. So I think, and contradict me if you will, and I'll try and argue with you, we have the largest set of publicly available urban sensing data in the UK, possibly Europe, because I haven't found anything better. All of our data is completely open. warts and all. And some of it is utter nonsense. But it's there. Every single observation that's ever made, every bit of metadata about that sensor, everything we know is public and open, and you can go and download, if you like, all 45 million observations now, if you like. Please don't, because I want to do a demo, we might have on the server. But so all of that data is available, it's all open, it's all free, and it's open to whoever wants to use it. Whether you want to use it commercially, whether you want to use it for research, whether you want to use it for your own personal gain. We started to get quite a lot of interest from user groups, and often conflicting user groups, who want to actually get deployments in particular locations now. They've seen the data and they say, can we have this here? Because we're interested in reducing traffic along Gosford High Street, for instance. So we're starting to get this. And I'm a techie at heart, so here's a techie diagram. This is our database. 7 columns. So our answer to how do you handle heterogeneous sensor platforms is you have mechanisms that are heterogeneous rather than fixed schema. So we have schemaless systems. We're currently deployed this in Postgres with PostGIS spatial interface, but we use this HStore data type, which is a NoSQL data type of key value pairs. So you can basically keep on adding key value pairs. So a typical, so this is how Postgres does its key value pairs when you do a query of it. So we have thematic themes of our data. We store the units with the observation. So if you want to do unit conversions on the fly, we can do that because the units are stored in the observation. The value here is whatever we've been measuring. So we've been measuring parts per billion of NO2. That's minus number, I don't know where that's come from. Sensor ID is here, timestamp is here. And you can keep on adding these key value pairs. You introduce a new sensor system and it's recording slightly different data under different units. It can be easily coerced into this system. The joy of this is when you write your interfaces, you're writing your interfaces off a single attribute, essentially, in a database. So we're writing all of our interfaces to go and grab the delightfully named info. So you don't have to change any of your interfaces, be they modeling or anything else. If you want all of the temperature readings across all of the sensor platforms, regardless of which manufacturer or whatever, you just have to do a search on temperature and off you go. We do put some control onto there, so we have particular tags that we understand. So this is the antithesis of the XML world. So we tag our data with, so we have a set of allowable tags that we can add to, so we don't have sort of problems with people putting temp rather than temperature and those types of things. So a very simple structure. This is currently being migrated to the Cassandra NoSQL database. Cassandra only because we have lots of experience in it. And then this is where the spatial data sits because the sensor has a location. So all of our queries are done in there and we're simply then bridging across to the NoSQL, eventually compliant distributed data sets that we can do in Cassandra so we can hopefully scale this. There are some challenges in there. So for instance, our Twitter data has a location embedded in the tag of the observation. So it's a moving sensor because it's wherever someone's tweeting from. And you can think of other sensors. At the moment, we can index the lat long field within the NoSQL data type in Postgres so we get very quick spatial response from it on spatial queries. When we move this over, we have to think carefully about how we do that in a NoSQL system because spatial stuff doesn't really work that great. There are some things going on in there, but how then do we do a spatial query on a bunch of moving data is something we're investigating at the moment.
Question.
Fire away.
Does the row ID and table name there refer to the source? Or is it what in the tags table? What was that a reference to?
I can't remember. Off the top of my head.
The tag is just this metadata applied.
The tag is just what's allowable in these things.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so whether it says the theme environment or theme weather, or whether it says temperature and those type of things, just so when we do queries, we're using a standard typology to make our queries, that's all it is. So where are we in terms of the moment? We just checked before I came here, we're now at 45 million observations. We have a daily throughput of 160,000 observations. At the moment, 165,000. In the next month, that'll ramp up to about 300,000. That number's not right, because some of those we've now removed the car park sensors, because they no longer exist. They've been offline for 8 months. So we're about 400 sensors out there, of which about 100 plus we've deployed. So all the others are existing sensors that we've just harvested in various ways. And that doesn't include Northumbria Waters data, because that's not open. That's operational data. And although we can use it in research, we can't actually provide it on the platform. That, for instance, is just tagged private in the database. So when you do a query on it, it's excluded. You exclude the ones that say private and they don't appear. We've got an approach of deploying hybrid scientific and low-cost platforms. We measure lots of different things about the environment. We're deploying 30-plus climate stations. We've just managed, after fighting with purchasing, managed to purchase a rain radar, which is going to sit on top of our sit on top of one of our buildings. We've just deployed an additional 30 air quality monitoring stations. They're coming online. We've got some internal building sensors going on, and then we've got the key building, the Urban Sciences building, when it comes on. We spent about £200,000, and we've got about £3.5 million to spend over the next 5 years in sensing infrastructure. So we're hoping to have a much larger deployment across the city, somewhere in the region of 1,000 sensors. Just to give you an idea, this is a big data problem, or it's a lot of data problem, not a big data problem. 1,000 sensors and 192 bytes per observation, give or take, is what's going into the database, gives us about 2 million observations a day, 10 million observations a day, but that's about 2 gigabytes of disk space per day in terms of when we hit 1,000 sensors. But if you start thinking of the building, where there's lots and lots of sensor feeds at very high resolution, and you start thinking about Earth observation and integrating those, even talk about bringing in video and things like that, we do end up with a very big data problem. Just so you know what we're talking about, these are some of my sensors on Science Central. So just at the back there, you can see where our new Urban Sciences building used to be. That's where they brewed Newcastle Brown Ale many years ago. And we're going to brew something brown and very different, I imagine, in the future there. I won't go into that. So these are what our sensors look like. These are our low-cost pervasive sensors. They cost about £2,000 a pop. Every 6 months we have to change the battery and the air quality. They're electrochemical air quality sensors. So we're working with people in stats, for instance, who are looking at our data and saying, actually, do we need to replace them every 6 months? What sort of drift do we have? Can we correct for it so we can keep them out there longer and reduce costs? So lots of interesting work going on just the raw sort of sensor technology. The elephant in the room, of course, is our data any good? So this is our data. This is at a notorious black spot in Newcastle called Cradlewell. We've got here three types of observations. So the blue one and the black one are scientific grade instruments that are supposed to be correct to within 1%. Now, I'm no mathematician, but that ain't 1%, so one of them's wrong. Our low-cost pervasive sensors that we're putting out in conjunction with these is the red line here, the moving average. So you can see there are places where it falls off and it doesn't respond at the same rate as some of these. And there's obviously some problem with one of these AURN sensors. One of them is wrong. But it's not bad. So in terms of data, you're certainly getting a picture of what's happening that's approaching reality. I'm going to tell you the tale of the lamppost, though, because it's, although the technology... Technology data. The tail of the lamppost is quite interesting. This is a
So this is the science. This is the middle of the Science Central site, which we are sensing through its development, and this sort of this is the area, the neighbourhood level, if you like, high density of sensors. What do we sense? How do we learn? We need a wireless gateway. In fact, we've got one on this lamppost now. We've got a wireless gateway attached to it. It's just a normal lamppost. It's actually owned by the university, which probably makes things harder than anything else. Yeah. This lamppost is owned by the university. So one lamppost, we want to put our wireless box there that transmits the data back to a server and eventually ends up in the observatory. The actual monitors talk by Zigbee all the way around the site, so it's a sort of wireless radio communication. This is a base station, so hence it needs power. They did ask me how much power it was going to take and who do we bill, and I paid them for 10 years in advance with a pound coin, because it takes virtually nothing in terms of voltage. So this is required to get access to this. Three committees to talk to, 9 meetings. We've been there 8 times, actually. It's now out of date because we went twice yesterday. We've had 4 engineers out, 327 emails, 42 telephone conversations, 45 people. When we got there to install the gateway, with all of the people, so we managed to get all of the people in there to unlock the lamppost, the electrician along to come and do it. As we were screwing it up and plugged it in, the guy says from the sensor company says it's not getting any power. And the engineer says, oh yeah, we switched the power off during the day. So that was our they have light sensors on, so they have a switch on and stuff on. So I said, okay, great, thanks for telling us. Now we've got this far, we have actually brought everyone here. I said, so we can sense at night, but at no other time. Brilliant, fantastic. How do we go and get this switched on? And that was 3 weeks ago. And there was a flurry of emails this afternoon, because we now need to find someone to put another timer on this. Why turn them off during the day? I have no. But this is just, I mean, it's just an example of actually deploying these things requires you to plow through bureaucracy and all the rest of it, and it's really quite hard work. And it's not straightforward. I'm going to finish off, I know I'm running out of time, with some applications of what we're doing with some of this data. This is some of the analysis we did for Northumbria Water, who said, who the hell uses our beaches? They're involved in all this clean water. Can you tell us who uses our beaches? So we analysed the Twitter data that we record as part of the observatory. So anyone who tweets in Newcastle, or the Northeast actually, and happens to have location enabled on their phone, semi-anonymized record, if anyone from Twitter's listening, a semi-anonymized record of your tweets is sitting in our observatory. But we managed to backtrack this from all the people, 540 people tweeted on Long Sands Beach in Tynemouth, if anyone's been there, very lovely beach, got a nice cafe as well. And we backtracked to where they most often tweeted from. So we're able to actually produce some good statistics to say how far do people travel. On average, it's about 16 kilometres. That's the average or the median distance, if you like, not the mean distance, because you can see there's global. We have people travelling from Chile and Australia, which tend to skew your statistics somewhat. We've also used Twitter data again, but this time we used Twitter data to control our GPU real-time flood modelling. So you're doing a sort of Monte Carlo simulation of very high-resolution flood models, but you don't know which one is best because they're very sensitive to input parameters. So essentially, where it's raining and how heavy will affect where it floods and for how long. So you can modify those and run multiple simulations. They take about 180 seconds to run a very high resolution for somewhere the size of Newcastle. So we can run those lots and lots and lots of times, but then we can use Twitter and tweets coming in from people to actually pick the best from that simulation. So we can actually pull the best record out, the best match from our model based on the data that's coming in real time. And an application of how we can start to integrate all of this stuff. We've got Earth observation data about rain coming in. We've got forecast data from things like the Met Office. We have observations from weather stations. We have traffic information and we have flood models. You start to see how bringing in multi-inputs, we can start to answer some questions. We can observe things before they happen. We can look at historic patterns to see, did that trigger an event and what kind of event it can trigger. We can run models in the background based on observations as they come in or forecasts, and we can hopefully get very high resolution data with things like our rain radars.
I won't talk about recomp because it's all computing science.
Air quality modelling goes on, and monitoring is obviously a big one. I think second only to flooding, it's the sort of biggie if you want to operate in this space. We're doing a lot of air quality monitoring, including managing traffic lights, so buses go through green lights, so they're not standing, so they have equipment on them. So monitoring corridors to say what happens when we implement these systems that allow buses and taxis to go through green lights, so they're not standing belching out fumes, and understanding what effect that has, both on traffic flows, which is what everyone complains about if you try and implement these systems. Oh, since you did that, it's taking me 10 minutes longer to get to work and the traffic's appalling. But also air quality, is it beneficial in terms of air quality? And you need a baseline to do that. Down to this little thing, which is urban gardening. So there's a bunch of urban gardeners. It's a big sort of community-based project in the north of Newcastle, which is fairly sort of run down and that sort of thing. And it's all about improving community, growing food. But what we've done there is we've also started to deploy air quality monitors there so that the community can see what's happening with their air quality. And you're there, it's more of an educative role, and we're trying to talk to people about air quality issues.
Okay. If you'll indulge me for 2 minutes longer, I will do the thing that you should never do, which is a real-time demo of this, which is of course working on mine but not on there, so we'll switch that. If you haven't had a look at this thing, go and have a look, send us some feedback, send us some comments, download the data, use the data however you will. Sorts of things that we monitor here, these are moving averages across the whole of the whole of the network, all of the sensors of a particular type. So these are these tags that you saw in the database being used essentially just to pull all of those things together, regardless of where it's actually being monitored, what equipment it's on, whether it's high quality, low quality. There's a data API that you can go and access this, so you can get that back through a sort of RESTful interface in JSON or CSV and pull that data. More likely, most people want to just download it in CSV and do it in that great modeling tool we call Excel and go and have a look at it in there. But even at this stage, where we're fairly low on, we do have a lot of data, and it's all available. Like, just showing you, this is traffic flow and sound. Traffic flow is really expensive and hard to monitor. You've got scoot systems or ANPR, expensive and hard to do. Sound is one of the things that's really easy to monitor and really cheap. Sound costs you almost nothing. It's incredibly reliable. The sensors last forever. They take no battery whatsoever. Sound we could use as a very good proxy for traffic flow, give or take. So maybe, actually, we don't want to monitor traffic at all, because that's too expensive and too hard. We'll just put lots and lots of sound sensors and do it that way. So if you haven't had a look at this, please do. Thank you very much for your attention.
It sounds like you're basically everything goes into the database for you anyway, so it's not really a streaming problem per se. You know, the stuff is coming at you so fast that you have to make essentially real-time decisions about what to ask, what to throw away, and you have to.
Yes and no. If there are people, for instance, who are using, although we are harvesting that data in real time and bringing it into databases, there are other people who are also using that data in real time before it gets into the database. Who are, you know, we're not trying to replace domain specific expertise and systems that people have already got up. So things are going into the database and then we're doing them. There is a whole bunch of research about doing things before it comes in, even to the point where you want to start tagging things as it goes into the database as, for instance, unreliable. Or you want to start doing event monitoring. And event monitoring from point-based observations is quite tricky because it could just be your sensor going AWOL. So actually you've got a spatial problem because you want to look at the sensors around it in real time and see if they're corroborating it in various ways. So we're not, you're absolutely correct, we're not actually doing anything other than dealing with the streams and then pumping them into the database. But most of these are streaming data that we just then pump into the database in a particular format.
So but the observatory isn't contingent on a streaming architecture, I guess is what I'm saying.
No, but the streaming API is our next API release, because that's the thing what people have asked for. They want to ask to continually get a sensor or set of sensors. So on top of this, we're building a socket-based streaming API that will push that data out.
William.
Yeah.
I'm not too convinced by the whole big data thing. I think it's going to go into the .com folder. I don't think there's anything in it. I hope you shot yourself in the foot when you said it's utter nonsense, but it's there.
Well, not all of it's nonsense. Some of it's nonsense. I think the point is that people are saying that it's really good.
Yeah.
And we're saying, actually, it's a much more nuanced set of data. And you need, you know, it's not just a matter of putting that thing out there, measuring it, and you've got a brilliant set of reading. It's much more nuanced.
I feel quite strongly it's just taking science in a whole new wrong direction. I think that even the word utter nuance, I think, is a nice word. Because take the example of who uses the beach. And so we went after, you know, Twitter data, and everybody talks Twitter, although there's a large community of people that argue that Twitter's got a lot to do with big data. But anyway, you often hear Twitter examples given. And Twitter is a tiny proportion of the people who go down to the local beach. It's a whole community of people who don't use Twitter. And then off Twitter, only 3% of those are geolocated, as I bet you know. So to take that poverty of data that's so completely, thoroughly unrepresentative of those people, and then to say, this is the answer to your question, who uses these beaches, I think is beautifully illustrative of the deep uselessness of that piece of research. And that what you should have done is take some poor student, which there's room for, and send them down and have them stand on the beach by the car park for a week, you know, and do it that way, because then you would get a representative sample in a consistent way, and you'd be able to measure the quality. So, obviously, I've framed it incredibly, very sort of snarly, but I feel deeply that in the absence of having any kind of meaningful quality control over many of these data sets, I think that we're fooling ourselves into believing that better data is giving us better information, and people aren't understanding the difference between the two things.
I think you're absolutely right. Twitter's a great example of we're not there yet. And when does it become representative? There will be a time that sort of data will be representative. You know, not necessarily Twitter, but it's about, one of the things that you're trying to do is develop systems that when those things get to a level of maturity where it starts to be a representative sample, for instance, of the population, that you are able to deal with that in some way. I would argue that lots of our other streaming data are reasonably good data. So our monitoring of environmental data, for instance, is good data. It may not be, particularly when you've got these pervasive sensors, and I think your argument is very strong there about how you need to frame your decisions and your analysis based on the types and the quality of the data you're input. And as I've tried to say here, there is a viper's nest of people saying we've got brilliant systems that allow us to monitor things at very high levels of precision and accuracy. They can always do it at precision, they can't always do it accurate. But we get representative data sets that are starting to tell us things about a city. And if you're starting to try and think of this
across very large scales, then you can't go and do this any other way. You can't go and sample in one location and then go and sample in another location, because that doesn't tell you anything. Because the characteristics of that location, they tell you what's happening at that particular point at that particular time. If you want to start extrapolating to larger scales, you have to do more monitoring. And we do get reasonable data, by no means perfect. And some of this early data, my utter nonsense, is some of our early sensors were just random noise generators. They were just white noise generators. So they'd be fine on temperature and noise, but CO and NO, they were just white noise generators. But they came from a manufacturer who said they were great and they'd last 2 years. 2 years.
It seems you would know quite a lot about what Twitter users like on the beach.
I have no idea what they like on the beach.
I was fascinated because you gave us a talk, a rigorous talk about how you might approach something, whereas many people like to talk about the answer they've come up with and their main body of research. So it's really interesting to see the guts of the system. I get the impression that you would unlike anybody else, have a really good sense of what Newcastle is like, sense of data, what it's. And maybe
it's a really data poor space.
Okay.
That's what it's like. I mean, you know, what have we got? We've got 100 point observations across a city. It depends what you define the city as. Even if we decide it as the city centre. The 20-hectare site that Science Central has, we currently have, there's nothing there. Well, there's a bit of a building site and one building. We've got 30 monitors. I don't know whether that tells me a huge amount about that. What I'm hoping, what we're hoping, is that we can look at that data over the long term and actually say, well, actually, 30 doesn't tell us any more than 3. So we can deploy 3 sensors in that area and we get a representative view of this. We do a lot of co-location. So multiple sensors of different types at different levels of accuracy at the same location. So you start to be able to understand what your data space looks like. But I think it's a very poor, you know, 40 million observations is absolutely nothing when you really think about it. It's a very poor data space. But, you know, you have to start somewhere.
I just have one question about the kind of issue with air quality is to do with, well, one issue is health,
yeah,
impacts on people. And I just wonder if you've got any sense of how the link between the pollution in Area A and who is exposed to it, how that could, you know, how your data could be used in combination with...
Well, one of the things that we've got some... a colleague of mine is looking at, which has been done before, but in a similar way, is combining. So the way you would look at air quality exposure now or pollution exposure now is you take model outputs, because there is no real-time other data. So that's all you've got. You've got model outputs. So any of these air quality exposure apps and things like that are just using model output, or they're using traffic data and then doing some probably fairly noddy modelling in the background as a proxy for air quality. but it's a really interesting question about how you take those models and then how you combine those with a reasonably sparse set of point observations. Because even the cheap air quality sensors are £2,000 straight out of your pocket, not to mention the man hours actually getting these things installed as per the lamppost. It would have been cheaper for me to pay my RA to walk to that lamppost every morning and replace a set of batteries, given the man hours for a year, given the man hours we've already put into attempting to deploy these things. So I think that's a really interesting question about how we combine point observations with model output in a robust fashion to provide better things like air quality exposure.
Thanks for a very enlightening talk. You were very cynical about standards.
you see terrible things and lost the will to live.
But in some ways you've created another data silo. If I want to do an analysis of pollution in the north of England or the UK as a whole, I need to be able to connect your data with Manchester's data, with Carlisle's data, with et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So somewhere in there we do need standards, and there really aren't any. So what are we going to do about this before we do end up with a whole lot of silos, which we then have difficulty finding?
And absolutely, part of the so part of the UCRIC funding is a number of cities across the UK who are all doing slightly different things, but along the same thing. And one of the themes there is, how do we start to share data, best practice, and start to look at those things? I just don't want it to be XML based. That's my, let's think of something else, folks. I just don't want it to be XML based. So, but you're absolutely right.
Why not?
Because the interpretation of XML is subject to individual flaws. So a standard is implemented in slightly different ways. So every time you start to look at an XML data set, although it's all supposed to be machine readable and you can configure it all, actually it takes an awful lot of handballing to actually get data that's nominally using exactly the same XML standard, typically, in my experience.
Is that a function of XML or is it a function of trying to understand it?
I suspect it's a function of how people write XML specifications and then turn them into actual data.
But also you have to worry about standard where containers do get the data.
A nested XML standard. But, yeah.
Well, it's really not hanging then. I don't know how to follow that, so thanks a lot.
Why don't you teach us about the number?
Yes, I'm not noticing. Right. Before you all run away, thank you all for coming. Thanks to the helpers for helping set up. And yes, thank you once again. Phil, thank you.